All right, good morning. It is Tuesday morning, April 27th, 9 o'clock. And we're doing experiment 38 this morning. We're looking at experiment 38, trying to scale experiment 38, picking up where we left off from the last lab meeting. And I had asked you guys to take a look at 38, and I said it wasn't going to be doing Canvas and that it wasn't a huge amount of pressure on this one. Although I wanted you to look at it and try to do it, which I may have taken too much pressure off. Maybe that nobody decided to actually look at it and see what was going on. And that's okay too. We can do it together this morning and kind of look at how this goes.
I totally forgot. The co-ops were distracting.
And as they should be, that material is more important. The lecture material is always takes priority over the lab material. So understood. Okay, let me... let me figure out. Oh, Brian, come on, screen share. I'll share with you guys kind of why my brain is not where it normally is. My wife got the COVID shot. What is going on? Your computer's attempting to access Zoom. Hold on, I'm getting new. Things are not. There we go. Okay, I upgraded my computer and my iPhone and my iPad. And it's doing some new funky things. Okay, as I was saying, my wife got the COVID shot last week, and her second dose, which is usually harder for Moderna. And we knew it was gonna be harder. And she has a number of different autoimmune diseases. One of them is where her body attacks her platelets, actually the platelets that are required for blood clotting. And her immune system has developed antibodies to her platelets. And when her immune system gets stimulated, her body attacks whatever is invading the disease or the illness, whatever it is, but it also attacks her platelets, knocking her platelets out. And usually a normal person, their platelets run between 150,000 and 450,000 per something. I don't know. I can't remember exactly what that is, if it's per milliliter or what it is. And so they, instead of saying thousands, they just report that number as like between 150 and 450. And so that's your normal numbers, 150 to 450. And she's been low before. If you get below, I think it's like below 20, it can be life-threatening because you can start to hemorrhage in your brain and other areas when you get below 20,000 platelets. And she got the COVID shot on Friday, the second COVID shot. She was super sick all weekend, high fever and pretty sick. And then she went in and had her numbers tested on Monday, and she was at two. Like two. which is super sort of emergency mode. And so we just needed to keep a really, really close eye on her all yesterday. And she's going in to get her platelets tested again today to see where she's at. And she's taking medication to try to get the bone marrow to release platelets. So little stressful. The brain is not quite working where I want it to be. So other question, how did my back appointment go? Which is also another really good thing to ask. The back appointment went well. They interpreted the MRI and they said that the disc is bulging, but not enough where they want to do the shots. So they think that the bulge is putting pressure on the nerves, which is what is the painful component, but the size of the bulge that they're seeing and the risk of going in and doing the injection, which I've had before, was more than they wanted to do right now. And so what they want me to do is tough it out for another 6 weeks and do some physical therapy in that time. And then after 6 weeks, we'll reassess and see if they want to do the shots at that point, if it's still not getting better. So I'm still kind of in the same kind of pattern, although we're going to give the physical therapy a good shot and see if that'll make a difference. So there's all the things going on in my life. And I know that we've all got, it's kind of, I don't mind sharing those things once in a while, because I know that we've all got things going on, and it helps when we understand each other and some of the things that are going on in our lives. It just, little empathy goes a long way. So I think that's also why I have a lot of empathy when you guys let me know what's going on in your lives. And I know that we all have our own journeys and our own things that we're going through. And it just takes a little bit of kindness and a little bit of patience and understanding, and it makes the world a much, much better place. Okay. Let's pick up. Let's see. Let's look at this next reaction that is reaction 38. Okay, you guys can see the screen share at this point. Reaction 38 for the Michael Aldall reaction. And this reaction is where we are taking the alpha beta unsaturated ketone that we made. So this was made in 37. And we're expecting that we have approximately 2 millimoles, hopefully, from this reaction, that this is what it would have yielded. And of course, our reaction too, in the way that this reaction has gone together, is that we have a substituent in our group, which has been placed onto this molecule. And what we're going to look at now is the next reaction, where we take ethyl acetoacetate and react it in ethanol with sodium hydroxide to produce a large molecule now that makes the six-membered ring system. Remembering where everything goes. And we get a double bond there. That's an important double bond. So that's the product that we're looking for in that R group is going to wind up over here on that molecule. Okay, so that's the whole thing that we need to do. And in looking at experiment 38 and the way they've got it set up, let me change colors. Maybe blue. And from 38 instructions, we are supposed to use 0.24 grams of calcone and 0.15 grams of the ethyl acetoacetate, 5 milliliters of ethanol, and 0.25 milliliters of 2.2 molar sodium hydroxide. And this is all supposed to be done in a 10 mil round bottom. So now what we can do is we can take those components, the mass of the calcone, the mass of the ethyl acetoacetate, and we can figure out what the scale of reaction 38 is. And then we've got 2 millimoles worth of this material that we would like to take through this reaction. And we can scale this reaction up for the 2 millimole size. That's essentially what we're trying to do here. And so if we take this and we talk or ask, you know, the question, how many, or maybe better yet, what millimole scale? Is reaction 38. And so we want to know how many millimoles of the calcone is 0.24 grams and also how many millimoles of ethyl acetoacetate is 0.15 grams. And figuring out sort of what scale this reaction is going to, we don't need to worry so much about the ethanol or the sodium hydroxide. The sodium hydroxide is catalytic in these reactions. And so the amount that is here is not super critical. The ethanol is a solvent, and we'll just scale those when we decide how many millimoles this reaction is set up to be. We'll scale those appropriately when we figure out the scaling factor. So that's the way that we would go through and do that. So the first thing is to take a look and figure out this thing, the calcone, without the R group. Let's just take the R group off and let's figure out what the molar mass of this is. And then how many millimoles, 0.24 grams of that calcone is. So the first thing that we're going to need there is we're going to need the molar mass. And in order to get the molar mass, we're going to need the molecular formula. So just getting the molecular formula is a critical component here. So we're at C, the way I do it is I just go 6, 12, 13, 14, 15. We're at C15. And then the H's I do sort of similarly. There are 5, 10, getting rid of the R group, 11, 12, and then my oxygen. And that should be my formula there. Might as well get the formula for ethyl acetoacetate while we're here too. This is a C, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. H, you've got 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And that's an O3, so C6H10O3. And for the product, we don't really need to do anything for the product because what we're concerned with is what were the starting materials that were thrown into this and how did they go together? What was the ratio of starting materials to each other? And so we don't need to worry about the product that we're making. We're just trying to figure out the reaction itself. So C15H12. That's now when we're doing these, this is different than when we did the mass spec. And in the mass spec, we used just the whole number of atomic masses for these guys. But here we want to use the average atomic mass. We want to use the values off the periodic table. So we're looking at 15 times 12.0114 plus 12 times 1.00794 plus 15.9994. There we go. So this is 208.27. And we'll get the other one, C6H10O3. And so I don't try to look these up. I just grab my calculator and you should be able to just punch these out pretty quickly, remembering your Chem 1A skills. And you may need to grab a periodic table in order to look at the masses of these guys. I always just try to keep them in my head. And if you do it to 4 sig figs, keeping in your head to 4 sig figs, that's always a good thing to do. So carbon 12.01, hydrogen 1.008, oxygen 16.00. So just keeping them at 4 sig figs is sufficient to do everything that you need to do. And then, of course, we want to take the 0.24 grams of calcone, and we want to use that molar mass of 208.27 grams calcone for every 1 mole. And then for every 1 mole, you've got 1,000 millimoles. And I like taking it, you can take it to moles. There's nothing wrong with moles. It's just millimoles are so much more convenient to work with, because it takes things down to essentially a small whole number that's gonna be 1, 2, 3, or 1.5, 2.5, rather than dealing with 0.0025. It's just an easier number to deal with in dealing with millimoles, and all of our reactions are millimole scale. So we might as well just take things and deal with them on millimoles. And most people coming out of Chem 1A and 1B, they've never dealt with a millimole, because you never really talked about the sizes of chemical reactions, and everything was dealt with in moles and we just left it in moles. But look at this, is a 1.15. And I know I'm not following correct sig figs here. I've got 2 sig figs here. This should be limited to 2 sig figs. And so if I were rounding it to 2 sig figs, come on, I would have been at 1.2. So we'll follow correct sig figs. So there's my 1.2 millimoles of calcone. So this is looking like it's a 1 millimole reaction. The question is, which one was in excess? Was it the ethyl acetoacetate, or was it the calcone that was in excess? So let's go ahead and get the ethyl acetoacetate as well. And if they had, given me a volume, then I would have needed to look up the density or gotten the density from someplace. Usually in the textbook, the density would be given to you, or we could always look it up in the Merck index, or even just Googling it will oftentimes give you the density easily enough. And this one, we've got 130.14 grams per mole. See where we're at, 0.15 divided by 130.14 times 1,000. That does not look right. Oh, because there's a subtraction that's in my, let's do it one more time. There was, in that first calculation I ran, if you look at it right here, it says answer subtract. That answer subtract took the previous answer and subtracted what we did and came out a little funky. So this is 1.2 millimoles as well. And so it's a one-to-one reaction. One-to-one ratio at 1.2 millimoles. And so we're desiring to do this at the 2 millimole scale. And we'll just scale this up, you know, anticipating that the reaction is going to run in a 50% yield. So we're going to scale this up to the 2 millimole. And if we want to scale it up to 2 millimole, then we just need to figure out what a scaling ratio is. So if we were at 1.2 millimoles, then what you're going to do is you're going to divide everything by 1.2, and then you're going to multiply it by 2.0. So this is existing scale, and this is desired scale. And then that's going to equal your scaling factor. And so our scale factor is going to be 2.0 divided by 1.2, 1.67 is our scaling factor. So we'll multiply all values by 1.67 to make a 2 millimole reaction. So then, we have our calcone, we have our ethyl acetoacetate, we have our ethanol and our sodium hydroxide. And this one, we're gonna use a specific reagent. So we'll come back and we'll deal with this one in a minute, but we can sort of get an idea of where we're going to be, that this is going to be 0.24 grams what is going on there we go let's clear everything out 0.24 times 1.67. So we're going to be 0.40 grams there. The ethyl acetoacetate was 0.15 times 1.67. So that's going to be 0.25 mil now. Or 0.25 gram of that material. The ethanol was 5 milliliters. And our sodium hydroxide was a tiny amount. It was 0.25 milliliters. And you can do this all by hand, all out like this. Sometimes when I'm scaling a reaction and there's a lot of things to scale, then I'll go to Excel and I'll just punch it into Excel and fill down and complete it out that way. And it makes it a lot easier. Okay, so let's just assume a density of approximately 1, which means that this is going to be about 0.40 milliliters. This one is going to be approximately 0.25 milliliters. And so total volume, as I bring all of those things together, is 0.4 plus 0.25 plus 8.35 plus another 0.42. Total volume comes out to 9.42 milliliters. And then just scanning really quick, if there's a workup associated with 38, they want you to add 2 milliliters of water and scratch the inside of the flask. And then you place that in an ice bath. So there was a workup where we add 2 milliliters of DI water. So we'll multiply that by 1.67 as well. That equals 3.67 milliliters. So now we're at a total volume of 13. Let's change this from total volume to total reaction volume. And then this is the total volume that needs to be accommodated when we consider the workup as well, which then that scales what size round bottom we need to go into, right? So remember that the round bottom sizes, when we look at flasks, they usually start off at like 5 mils, 10 mils, then they go up to 25 and 50 and then 100. And then from 100, they usually go to 250. These are standard sort of increment sizes. And at 13, it's a little bit more than halfway, but I think that we would be best suited to be in a 25 mil round bottom as opposed to a 50. Going to a 50, what happens is if you go and we look at a 25, then volume wise, you're going to be sort of like here at the end of your workup in the 25 mil round bottom. And we're a little bit more than halfway than where we'd want to be. But if we went to a 50, the problem with going to a 50 is that you're way down here in a 50. And this is a lot of surface area to lose your chemical reaction to when you go to the workup phase and starting to try to police everything out. And so, yes, within reason, we don't want to be more than half full. But what I would say is that this is half full plus or minus maybe, I can't do it in milliliters, so maybe I need to do it in percent, plus or minus like 10%, so that you can go a little bit more than half full there and still make it work and still have enough headroom. What you're worried about in these cases is you're worried about how much volume you have here for expansion if the reaction were to bump or to heat or to expand for any reason. You want adequate headroom within these reactions in order to allow for expansion. And yes, you have plenty of headroom within this system here, more than you need. And so I think some other concerns start to take over where you're trying to design the chemical reaction where you actually don't want to lose too much material by using too big a round bottom. And we're so far below 50% in this thing that that's why I would choose to go with the 25 mil round bottom as opposed to the 50 mil round bottom. If that makes sense.
Could you scroll up just really quick?
Yeah. How far?
My volume just wasn't coming out the same. So I wanted to take a picture of it and then backtrack where I went wrong.
Okay. How about like all that?
Right. We're good.
Okay. So I think we've got this one scaled and figured out. And previously in the other lab, we had scaled the previous reaction. So what do we do now? What we would do is we would be assigned a derivative. And then once we were assigned that derivative, we would take that specific derivative and go through and perform these calculations one more time with that specific derivative, figuring out exactly the masses that we would weigh out and how we would run each one of these reactions. The only thing that's going to change in that case is the molar mass of your calcone is going to change, and the amount of the calcone that you get in order to make 2 millimoles would change. The ethyl acetate, the sodium hydroxide, the ethanol, none of that is going to change. It's only this guy, because of the substituent that we would put on it, that would actually change. So let me go back, if I can find it. Should be this one? No, should be this one. This is where we introduced the Michael Aldall, and we looked at the chemistry of the reactions, and then we looked at scaling. And we went through and we scaled this one. I'm trying to see, we didn't do it quite the same way that I did it for the one that we just went through for experiment 38. I just had all the question marks for 37. And I don't see where I actually did the numbers, but we know that it was a 4 millimole reaction that we wanted to run. There it is. That's what I was looking for. And so in the first reaction in 37, they had used 0.12 milliliters of the acetophenone, 0.15 grams of the benzaldehyde derivative, 0.8, 0.10 milliliters of the ethanol and the sodium hydroxide. And what we had done is took everything and added it all up and to figure out how big millimoles that reaction was. It was a 1 millimole reaction that we were looking at. And then what we did is we scaled each one of these things up, and we figured that we needed 0.48 milliliters of this guy. We needed 4 millimoles, which worked out to be 0.545 grams of that material. We scaled up each one of the solvents and the base, 3.2 and 0.4, and we scaled up the workup, and then we figured out how much volume that was, and we put it into a 25 mil round bottom flask. So in order to now make this specific for the derivative that we were going to use, what I'll do is I'm gonna copy this and take it into our current file. And we'll say that this is from last class calculations for experiment 37. We'll drop those in there. And now what we'll do is we'll take the derivative that we're going to work with. And let's say that we're going to do the nitro derivative. And we're asked to go through and figure out how to do this reaction for the 4-nitro derivative. And so what the reaction is going to look like is we're going to start off with acetophenone, and we will react it with benzaldehyde. That has the 4-nitro group on it. I think it's 4-nitro, should be. And this will be ETOH, sodium hydroxide. And we will make the calcone that specifically has the 4-nitro group on it. And then in the second reaction, we will take that calcone and react that with ethyl acetoacetate. Sodium hydroxide, and ethanol to make the Michael Aldall product derived from that. Okay, so those are the two reactions that we want to run, and we want to run this one at a 4 millimole scale, and we want to try to run this one at a 2 millimole scale. Now, we may have to adjust on the fly on the second one, because depending upon how many millimoles we get, we can scale the reaction up, or we may have to scale it down if we don't get 2 millimoles out of our chemical reaction, out of the first reaction. And so what we would do is we would go through and we would run this. And we have these calculations that we have done now. So this would be 0.48 milliliters. So these calculations, 0.48 milliliters is what we would want. That would be, I don't think I calculated it in grams. It would be nice if I had this grams, because we need to weigh this and make sure that we're in the right place with that. So we'll calculate out what those grams are.
I think it was grams, and then you were just like, assume it's one.
I think I did that, but I think that what I did here is I went back to using the volume that they used. Let's see. I know what you're saying, and I know that I did that at one point, but I think here it is. They actually used 0.12 milliliters of the acetophenone. And then we used the density 1.03 grams per milliliter. And then it's molar mass. And then we calculated out how many millimoles it is. We could take this milliliters and this density 1.03 and calculate out how many grams it should be. So if we know it's a 1.03 density, oops, it's going to be close. 0.48 milliliters, grams per milliliter, so times 1.03. So this is going to be 0.494, we'll just call it 0.49 grams. So then we can check our mass and we know exactly when we measure the mass. It's always a good idea that after you take the mass on the balance and you've got it recorded in your notebook, that you compare it to what you were supposed to obtain, so that you know whether or not you have excess or less, and you can adjust other things accordingly if you need to, if you take a little too much or not quite enough. Okay, calculator out of the way. We were supposed to be 3.2 milliliters here. We were supposed to be 0.4 milliliters on the sodium hydroxide. And we wanted 4 millimoles of this, which we had calculated out for the specific formula that we were borrowing from the textbook and calculated out how many grams that is. But we should do it for our 4 millimoles and for the molar mass of our compound here. So this one, we should do really quickly, 0.004 moles. Being able to go back and forth in your head between millimoles and moles is a good thing. Just relieves a step in writing it out if you need to. But 0.004, this is 4/1000ths of a mole. That is 4 millimoles. And we'll multiply that by the molar mass for every 1 mole. We need to know what the molar mass on this is. So this is C6H7. We've got 4, 5 hydrogens plus we've got a nitrogen plus we've got 2 oxygens. 0.16 grams for that material. And we'll multiply that by 0.004, 0.54 grams. All right, so we've got that reaction entirely scaled, and we know exactly what we need in order to be able to go through and do that reaction. Okay, any questions about what I'm doing so far?
It doesn't matter, but I think it's 0.13, not 0.16.
0.13, where 0.13?
135.13. It was like 0.125, and I think you just looked at the five.
You're right. Okay, but then when I calculated it out, I think I just took that and multiplied it by 0.00. So the answer was correct. I just wrote it wrong when I was there. Thank you for catching that. Okay. And after my wife getting her platelets, she's up to 12. So that's way better than two. I'm gonna breathe a little easier now. Okay. So now that we've got that one scaled, we can scale the next one real quick off the numbers that we just used. I'll make a little bit more room here. Okay, so the things that do not change are these guys, ethyl acetoacetate, ethanol, sodium hydroxide. The only thing that's going to change is the calcone. We'll come back and we'll calculate this one in a second. It's 0.25 grams of ethyl acetoacetate. So down here, we're at 0.25 grams. The ethanol was 8.35 mils and 0.42 mils of sodium hydroxide. So there's those. And then this one, I said we would scale. So this one, we're going to do 0.002 moles. And we're going to multiply that by its molar mass. But we need to know for every one mole what its molar mass is. Formula is going to be 6, 12, 13, 14, 15. Plus hydrogens is going to be 5, 4 is 9, 10, 11. We need a nitrogen. And we need 3 oxygens. So this is 253. 0.26 grams. And then we will multiply that by 0.002 in order to take it to 2 millimoles. Nice number to work with. 0.51 grams is what we would be weighing out there for that material. Okay, so now we've got them both entirely scaled. Now what we would do is we would start off down the first one, take our 4-nitrobenzaldehyde, weigh out the 0.54 grams, go ahead and add it in with the ethanol, and then add in the acetophenone, and then add in the base, and then heat it up and see what happens. Now, prediction-wise, let's talk about this, because some of these reactions, I said, fail, and they can fail in various ways. The reaction can run too fast, or the reaction can run too slow. And there's some ways of dealing with it if it runs too fast, and there's some ways of dealing with it if it runs too slow. So let's take a look at the original reaction that we wanted to create, what we wanted to happen. We wanted to, mechanism-wise, pull the proton from here. This is the first reaction. That tree is enolate. That enolate then is the nucleophile. That nucleophile attacks the benzaldehyde. And we have an R group out here. I'm going to get my arrow a little closer to where it's supposed to go. I'm supposed to go to the carbon. And once that does that attack, this is where we have created the new chemical bond. This is the rate determining step that happens here. This is your new bond that has been created. The benzaldehyde then has an O minus. And there's some other things that happen after this. But the things that happen after that are not as important as that rate determining step, right? So that when we're looking at this as a reaction path, in pulling the proton, we go to a high energy intermediate, and then we probably come down to something like this, which is an intermediate, before we drop down to something down here. So I think that our chemical reaction is going to look something like this, where this is our activation energy and our rate determining step. If that is truly our rate determining step, then I've got it wrong. I was trying to use Hammond postulate in order to draw it out. But I think that what I need to do is I think that this one just simply might be higher in energy yet. Okay, so this would be the enolate. And then this would be the adduct. And that's my rate determining step. And then I need to figure out what is going to make this reaction go fast and what is going to slow this reaction down. And it's going to have to do with the R group. Okay, we're in a better position now. All right, remember your Hammond postulate. Hammond postulate says that this transition state is most similar to the side that it is closest in energy to. So the transition state is going to look most like what's going on over here. And whatever stabilizes this, whatever makes this go down, is going to bring down your transition state. Whatever makes this destabilized and go up is going to increase your transition state, which is going to slow your reaction down. So if we take this and we stabilize it and we bring this down, that's going to bring this down and make the reaction go faster. Whatever destabilizes this and makes this go up is going to make this go up, and it's going to slow your reaction down. Does that make sense? I know my drawing's not super pretty, but
so we're going to talk about like activating and deactivating.
Yes.
Okay.
But when we talk about activating and deactivating, we used that word specifically when we were looking at aromatic substitution reactions. We talked about activating and deactivating groups or aromatic substitution reactions. This is not an aromatic substitution reaction, but the activating and deactivating language still applies. So think about, tell me what kind of substituents here, and there's only really two types of substituents, right? We have electron donating groups and we have electron withdrawing groups. So what is going to stabilize this charged intermediate? An electron donating group and an electron withdrawing group?
I want to say withdrawing because there's that negative charge.
That's exactly right. You go with your intuition. You go with your gut. And that is spot on. So what we find is that because electron withdrawing groups, let's actually do it in blue, because electron withdrawing groups are going to decrease the negative charge here and spread it over a larger area, delocalizing it, that will stabilize this negative intermediate. And that means that an electron donating group is going to do the converse. It's going to destabilize it. And we're going to find that electron donating groups are going to push this the other way and make this reaction run slower. So now we can take a look at all of the groups that are within this experiment. So the groups that are in this experiment normally, I don't do this in the course of the class. I don't necessarily want people to anticipate whether or not their reaction is going to work or not work, or how it's not going to work. I basically let them try it, let it fail, and then ask them what happened and ask them to do this thought process. But because we can't go through that, and I can't just, you've got no visual to understand how your reaction failed or what happened, this is a better thought process to go through. All right, so the groups in the experiment, the R groups, is we have a methyl, a methoxy, a chlorine, and a nitro. And what I would say is that the original was just a hydrogen. And so now we need to sort of rank these groups as to whether or not these groups are electron withdrawing or electron donating in terms of how these groups perform. So we have to envision taking the group and placing it in this position and whether that group is an electron withdrawing group or an electron donating group. And maybe you could take a look at these and I could ask you which one of these would be the strongest electron withdrawing group. Do you have a sense of which ones are electron withdrawing and which ones are electron donating? Oh, Drew's got one. NO2. Okay. Sorry, I wasn't looking at the messages. Yes, Drew, you're on. The nitro is the strongest of the withdrawing groups. Let me ask you this too. Are we concerned about resonance or are we concerned about induction? Look at where the R group sits. If I had like an oxygen here and I pushed electrons in, I would have to push these over and push these over. But can I push more electrons up onto this oxygen in a resonance sense?
Negative.
Negative. Negatory, no. Which means that resonance is not at play. I need to look at all of these groups and evaluate by induction. It's not about their resonance. It's about their induction and how they perform inductively. So what we've said is now nitro group is the strongest electron withdrawing group that's in this list. What would be my strongest electron donating group? Induction donating group.
The methyl?
The methyl, yes. Okay, and then what is a stronger, so this is strongest electron donating group. And then between the chlorine and the oxygen, which one is more electronegative, chlorine or oxygen? What do you think? I'll give you a hint. Chlorines, AJ is going for chlorine. Halogens do not substantially change the electronegativity of a hydrocarbon because their electronegativity is fairly close to carbon, with the exception of fluorine. I would say fluorine is 4.0, but chlorine is not that electronegative.
I'm going to go to the oxygen then.
Yeah, the oxygen, exactly. So what we would find then is that we go chlorine and then we go methoxy. And that these guys here, these are electron withdrawing. And the methyl is the electron donating group. And where hydrogen fits in into this scale, hydrogen is probably, it's not an electron donating group, but we would probably just put the hydrogen here, sort of at the dividing line between the two. And that the only group that's in this that is really an electron donating group is the methyl, and that the chlorine and the methoxy are electron withdrawing groups, and the nitro is the strongest of those electron withdrawing groups. So that means that these reactions here, these are gonna go slow, and this is gonna go fast. And what works out in this reaction that's really interesting is that the chlorine derivative and the methoxy derivative, the methoxy actually changes its solubility a little bit, and it has trouble solidifying because of its solubility. But the reaction goes pretty quickly. The chlorine, the reaction goes pretty quickly. The methyl group needs a little bit more time because its reaction is slowest. This one outright fails when you add in the sodium hydroxide. What happens with this one is it should be sort of a light tan colored compound that winds up precipitating out and being made as the product. And as soon as you add the base to this reaction turns black and solidifies, and it looks like it's been burned in an oven. It looks like it's just charred. And what has happened is the nitro group has accelerated this reaction so fast that there's many different side reactions that wind up happening, and the reaction goes too quickly. And so what are some of the options if we want to try to slow this reaction down? So if we take a look at the reaction and what's happening, given that I've given you the nitro group, this is, I think we said it was about 10 molar. And ETOH. And this runs at room temp. So we're running it right around 18 degrees Celsius or 20 degrees Celsius, somewhere in that range, 18 to 20 degrees Celsius.
What if we chilled the reaction a little bit? Would that help slow it, or Yeah, slow it down a little bit.
If we did what to it?
If we chilled it.
Chilled it, yeah.
On a cooler temp.
Yeah, ideas to slow it down. Good. Maybe run it at 0 degrees. Or maybe even colder if 0 degrees doesn't slow it down. Any other ideas to slow this reaction down?
Decrease the molarity of the sodium hydroxide used.
Perfect. Oh my God, that's awesome. Okay, so decreasing the molarity, there's two ways to deal with the sodium hydroxide. One way to deal with the sodium hydroxide is to decrease the molarity. So take the 10 molar and maybe use a 2.2 molar or a 2 molar or something that's a smaller molarity sodium hydroxide. The other way to do it is to decrease the molarity by decreasing the volume. You could just use less of the sodium hydroxide. They both achieve the same thing. That by dropping down the catalyst, drops down the amount of enolate that is produced, which then slows the chemical reaction down because the reaction is concentration-based. It takes collisions. And it is a bimolecular rate law where the rate law includes both the enolate and the benzaldehyde derivative. And so if you decrease the concentration of the enolate, then it will decrease the rate. And how do I decrease the concentration of enolate? I decrease the amount of sodium hydroxide that was originally creating that enolate. So we could do it that way as well. There's another way that we could do this, and that is that we could make the enolate and we could add the enolate slowly to the benzaldehyde. Or we could also add more solvent and we could make the solution more dilute. So these are other ideas that would not, possibly reduce concentration of reaction with more solvent. Order of addition. So these are all ideas to slow it down. And really the primary one that I go for that I instruct people to do is to both do less and decrease. We combine these two and we use two drops of the 2.2 molar sodium hydroxide that was designed for the second reaction. Two drops of that 2.2 molar, and this reaction goes beautifully. Just decreasing that amount of that catalyst of sodium hydroxide winds up making this reaction go and works pretty well. What if we had the other problem? What if we needed to speed this reaction up? What are ways that we could speed this reaction up? Let's say we had the methyl and we wanted to make sure that we had a higher yield of this. What would we do to speed this reaction up?
Heat the reaction.
Yep. Give me another one.
Increase the molar concentration of NaOH.
That's right. There's something else yet that we could do, given some of the other things that are here.
Less solvent.
Yes. Make the reaction more concentrated. And so by reducing down the amount of solvent and increasing the concentration of the reaction, we could also speed the reaction up. So yeah, Drew, all those things, Drew was hitting it in the text as well. So that's perfect. And these are kind of the things in thinking about reaction theory when you're actually going into the lab that we never really talk about in lecture, but these are ideas and concepts that we bring into lab that we look at in lab. Scaling chemical reactions, what to do when a reaction fails, how to diagnose a reaction and figure out what went wrong and then troubleshooting and how to correct it. And the whole idea of troubleshooting and how to correct it goes back to reaction theory, understanding where your rate determining step is and understanding how to influence your rate determining step. So those are all the concepts that I kind of wanted to hit today. And this is great. You guys are right on target. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I want to do with this.
I had a super quick question about when we calculated stuff for the 4-nitro derivative.
Yeah.
So it seems when we were doing the scaling for 37 and 38, we had, I thought, a mask for the trans calcone when we did, like, we took it from 0.24 grams and then we just times it by that ratio. Factor. Why did we do the molar mass this time rather than just using that number?
Ah, okay. Good question. They're all good questions. I don't know why I always say that. that's an excellent question, though. Because what we did before when we were scaling this reaction, and I got to go back up and find it. What we did is we found our scaling factor, and then we used that scaling factor to multiply by the 0.24 grams of the calcone to figure out how many grams of that calcone we needed. That calcone was taken to be the derivative, I want to go to the drawing, where R was a hydrogen. And so I was just running it based on what they ran it in the book with the derivative that had no substituent here, just a hydrogen here. And so I scaled it based on their numbers using the scaling factor. And there's that scaling factor. And I took their mass and used the scaling factor to scale it up, assuming that I was taking it from 1.2 millimoles to 2 millimoles. I could have calculated the molar mass of this and multiplied 0.2 millimoles by the molar mass, and I would have come out with the same amount of grams. But I was trying to show you and demonstrate how to use a scaling factor and how to apply it to everything. Then when I wanted to do this for real, and I wanted to do it with our derivative with the nitro, I couldn't just use the scaling factor to multiply this, because this had a different molar mass than the original. So what I did is I used the scaling factor on all the things that were identical to the first reaction, but then used the 4 millimoles and the molar mass of specifically this derivative to get the right number of grams. And I did the same thing in this reaction.
And then what about for that ketone with the 0.49, because that should have stayed the same, right?
And it did. All I did was take the 0.48 and use its density to convert the milliliters into grams, because I just wanted to know what its mass would be. I couldn't remember what the density was. I didn't remember how close the density was to one. And if the density was off from that, let's say it was 1.25 grams per milliliter, or it was 0.7 grams per milliliter, then its mass would be substantially different. And I wanted to know, when I put it on the balance, I want to have a sense of how close did I get to the value that I'm supposed to have, so that once I weigh this out, I know whether or not I need to shift some of the other things in my reaction and go back and do my calculation again.
Alrighty, that clears that up. Thank you.
Awesome. Those are great questions. All right, anything else come up for anybody as we were kind of going through this? This is one of those things where it's fine and dandy for me to tell you how to do it. It's a whole nother thing for you to sit down and to go through and do the scaling factors and to rescale a reaction. So maybe what I need to do for next class is to put together a little assignment, give you guys a reaction that I want you to scale, and not worry so much about all of the mechanism of the reaction and everything, but just give you a chemical reaction and tell you that I want you to scale it to a specific size, and then to tell me what size sort of round bottom is in there. So maybe I'll create a couple of exercises like that and let you guys practice the skill set of scaling a chemical reaction. But I think for this morning, I think this is pretty much where I wanna cut it. this as much as I want to do with this, because it's hard to push this anymore without actually being able to go in and do the experiment and have questions on how we set things up and manage things. But we've talked about all of the preliminary scaling things that I would have done in the lab setting before turning you guys loose and letting you go through and actually try this, which is, it's a great experiment to do. I love this. And to just to give you guys one more sort of insight into this reaction, which is really nice. When I first started teaching OCHEM, which is now almost 25 years ago, Pavia, the original versions of Pavia, had the nitro derivative in the textbook. And if you look in the version 5 of the textbook, you won't see the nitro derivative listed in the textbook anymore. They took it out. And the reason they took it out is because comments from chemistry instructors attempting to use the Pavia book could not make the nitro derivative work. The nitro derivative failed for everybody, and their students couldn't figure out how to make the reaction work. And so what was fun is that even in our first class with the nitro group, when we did this experiment, we figured out how to make it work. And then it just took some little hints now and then for every subsequent class to be able to figure out how to make that nitro derivative work. The other ones were a little bit easier. The nitro one was really tough. And Pavia, we had a computational chemistry meeting at Cabrillo where Pavia was actually invited, and it was a meeting that I was running. And Pavia came, and he and I actually got to sit down and talk about the reactions a little bit. And he explained that, yeah, they thought the nitro group could work, and they just couldn't get it to work, and they pulled it out of subsequent versions. And I showed him how we were able to make that work, which was really kind of fun in talking about the book. So I keep that nitro group in there just because I think it is so interesting that it does fail in the way that it does, and how you need to look at electron withdrawing groups and donating groups, and just thinking through some of these ways of slowing down a reaction or speeding up a reaction become important in thinking through how do I fix something that's not actually working. So cool stuff. Okay, let's cut it there. Let's take a break. I'll see you guys back at 11 if anybody wants to jump in for office hours. And if not, then I'll see you at 12:40 for lecture. And we've got lots of good aromatic reactions to go through, and these electrophilic aromatic substitution reactions. All right. Thanks, you guys. Take care.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Drew. We'll see you soon.